Okay, good morning, everyone. It's so good to be with you again. This morning, we're going to be looking at one of my favorite new texts. This is a text that I learned towards the beginning of this COVID time period back in March or April. And it's a text that the learning from it has really just stayed with me and come back to me over and over. And I'm so curious. I'm really looking forward to learning it with you, and specifically hearing your thoughts and reflections on it, of how this text is resonating or not resonating with you in this time period. So last week, for those of us that were on the call together, we were thinking about the upcoming holidays. We were thinking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And we think about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur really as a time in our tradition, in our Jewish calendar, times that are really about hope, the hope of Rosh Hashanah, the hope of new potential. I mean, even thinking about the joy of Yom Kippur as this joyous holiday, one of the two most joyous days of the year. And part of that joy is about the joy of having a new slate, of wiping everything clean, of having all of the world and all of the potential be open to us. And the questions we were asking is, how do we lean into that hope? How do we lean into the joy of Yom Kippur amidst so much sadness, amidst so much loss? And we turn to the writings of Rabbi Nachman for his thoughts on resilience, of how to hold both the sadness of the world, the despair in the world, while at the same time having this commandment to constantly be striving towards joy. Today, we're going to be specifically looking at beginning again, and beginning again amidst brokenness. So the Rosh Hashanah liturgy, we hear over and over the refrain, Hayom Harat Olam, today is the day when the world is conceived, when the world comes into conception. The idea being, and we also, even in the Torah portion, in the Haftorah portion, we hear the birth stories of Hannah and of Sarah and of Hagar. So these multiple births and difficult births. And so I think one of the questions that we ask ourselves on Rosh Hashanah, or something that I'm thinking about, are what are the new potentials that are waiting for us in the near to come, in the year to come? What is waiting to be birthed? What is waiting to be brought in this world? And how do we support that growth? But the question that I'm thinking about, that I want to explore with you today, is what does it look like to begin again on Rosh Hashanah? What does it look like to begin again this holiday season in the midst of so much loss? And a second question is, what lessons, as we go forward from the world we are in now to the world that we are going to build, that we are going to create together, what are the lessons and the learning we're going to carry forward from the old world into the new world, into this new world that is about to be birthed? And what will that new world look like? So what does it look like to be rebuilding amidst loss? And what is that new world going to look like that we are going to build together with this new holiday season? I'll say personally, I have just been thinking a lot about the story of Noach. Rabbi Avi Kilip, who is on faculty at Hadar, I think she put this framing in my head for me. I think she's also been thinking about the story of Noach. But the story of Noach as a time in which God brought the floods, in which, you know, we started off, the world was water and chaos and wind, and then God ordered the world and new life was created and it was good. And then God saw fit to basically destroy the world, to wipe out existence. And so God brought the flood. But before God brings the flood, God tells Noah and his family and his animals to go into the ark. And so while the world is out there being flooded, while it's being erased, they are holed up in this ark. And it feels to me just like a really parallel frame to the moment that we are in right now, that there's a sense in which the world that we know, the world that we recognize, is in the process of being flooded, of being forever changed. It's going to be a world that when we finally emerge from the ark, we're not going to recognize it. And in the meantime, we are each all holed up in our individual and in our communal arcs. And the question that I see in the story of Noach, and the question that I'm thinking very much for ourselves, is what is it going to look like when it's finally time to come out of the ark? How will we know when it's time to come out of the ark? What is it going to feel like to come out of the ark? And what is that experience going to look like? What is the world going to look like when we emerge? And how will we begin rebuilding again? So just to get that frame into your mind, and we'll drop a link for the source sheet in the chat, I just want to briefly look at some of the verses of Noach, just so that we could hear some of that language. So we see in the story of Noah that the flood continued for 40 days. And also just thinking about Noah, right? They go into the ark for 40 days. The flood is going to be for 40 days, but they end up staying so much longer. Feels parallel to our situation that we thought we were going in for a short amount of time, but actually we find that we're in this position an indefinite amount of time, which makes it all the harder to leave the ark and to begin to look at rebuilding. So I just want to look at that second paragraph here. And all the flesh that stirred on earth perished. Birds, cattle, beasts, and all the things that swarmed upon the earth and all of mankind. All in whose nostrils was the merest breath of life, all that was on dry land, died. Vayimach et kol hayakum asher al pnei ha'adama me'adam ad behema. And all existence on earth was blotted out. Man, cattle, creeping things, and birds of the sky, they were blotted out from the face of the earth. The language there, vayimachu min ha'aretz, is so extreme that this world that is outside has been basically totally obliterated. Even once they're finally able to leave the ark, what is the world that they're going to see, that they're going to encounter? Vayisha'er ach Noach ve'asher ito b'teva. Only Noach was left and those that were with him in the ark. There's a beautiful midrash on the word ach there, that the word ach only is a word of miyut, of sort of minimizing, and says even though Noach remained alive, he was not the same Noach, that when Noach emerged from the ark, he was still coughing up blood from the cold, that even Noach didn't emerge completely whole from the ark. We'll just go down to the next paragraph. God spoke to Noach saying, Tse min hateva, go out from the ark, which is to say, again, there's another midrash on this language of tse, that even when Noach saw that the floods had stopped, even when Noach saw that the waters had go down, Noach wasn't ready to leave the ark. Why? He was scared. Maybe he was scared of what he was going to find. He was scared whether or not the flood was over. And maybe he was scared because there was a sense of, there's another midrash here that says, well, he says to God, well, what's the point? What's the point that I'm going to go out and leave the ark and begin to rebuild and be fruitful and multiply just so that you'll bring another flood? And then God promised, and then in that midrash, God promises, never again will I bring the waters of the flood. But here the language that God has to, that Noah doesn't just come out of the ark on his own, but God has to command Noah and say, go out from the ark. It is time to rebuild. Because sometimes even when it's time to rebuild, it's hard to begin that work of rebuilding. So God said, come out of the ark together with your wife and your sons' wives. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds, animals, and everything that creeps on earth, and let them swarm on the earth and be fertile and increase. So I just want to have this text of Noah in our minds as a frame. I'd love to hear, you know, just a few comments of how does this work for you how does this resonate for you right now as a frame for thinking about the moment we're in? What do you imagine it was like for Noah and his family to leave the ark? What do you imagine that experience was of going out and seeing the world? And what do you imagine, the Torah doesn't really tell us this, but what do you imagine were those first steps of rebuilding? What does Noah do first? What did his family do first? What did the animals do first? How do they begin to rebuild the world after it's nearly destroyed?
So as someone who would stay at home for the rest of her life, all my life to get out across that threshold has been the hardest step every day, you know? And thank God I had kids because they have to go to school. And that's often what got me out of the house when they were little. But I understand you're not the only one who's been teaching Rabbi Nachman lately. And I could not understand like why he was flooding everybody's brains, but now I get it. But I'm reminded of the line from the REM song. It's the end of the world as we know it. Like the world is always changing. I mean, this is a huge change. I get it. But for someone who always sees chaos out there, like this is, to me, is just a bump.
Great. And Sarah, I so appreciate that, quoting the REM line, it's the end of the world as we know it. And we're going to come back to that idea, Sarah, the flood is one moment of an end. We might feel like we are in one moment of an end in the sense the world as we know it is changing. But the text that we're going to look at is going to speak to exactly that point, that there's a sense in which the world is constantly sort of being remade and rechanging, and we're experiencing these ends. And then the question is, what do we do with that? Just also want to highlight Bachi's comment in the text box that I appreciate. Maybe he had gotten so used to that narrow life in the arc, it felt inconceivable to go back to another fuller way of life. Hannah, go for it.
It's so interesting because when we were still in the lockdown on Shavuot, and I was thinking of the same sort of idea when I was thinking of like Pesolecha, that the Torah, the Ten Commandments, were built on the rubble of the first commandments. So it's the same idea. I was thinking about this even in lockdown that, you know, we're going to be rebuilding the Torah. And now we're Hayom Harat Olam. Now we're getting ready for Rosh Hashanah. Now we're rebuilding the whole world. So, this isn't the only text that has to do with rebuilding the world on rubble. It seems like having taken the idea of the Ten Commandments are built on rubble, and then now the world is built on rubble. It seems like we're reinforcing we're really in touch with that very fundamental. Now we have an opportunity at this point. So when I think about rebuilding, is like now where we are in time is a moment where we can really see this as an opportunity to be fundamentally connected to that spirit of Judaism that is built on something that's been destroyed and then rebuilt. So that's the only, this actually made me for the first time really kind of positive, like, oh, wait a minute. Now we're actually in touch with something. It's not just loss.
Yeah, beautiful. Exactly right. And it's also so beautiful to connect it to the idea of the tablets also sort of being coming out of the destruction and being rebuilding of that. That's a perfect thing to connect it to. I'll just go to the chat for a minute. Rebecca says, while we miss physical closeness, it's going to be terrifying when we can be close again. I think about that all the time, Rebecca, and I feel like it also really relates to the Noach text of it's not going to be a light switch where one day we realize, okay, we can start hugging and being physically intimate to all of our friends. It's actually going to be a much more confusing and complicated and awkward and as you said, terrifying. And so what are those stages of reopening going to feel like? And you see that if you go back to the Noach text, we're not doing this inside today. You see that in the Noach text, that it's like the waters stop and then Noach waits. And then Noach waits some more. And then he waits some more. And then he waits like another 7 days. And then there's another 7 days that there's actually a lot of stop and starts of coming out of the ark. It's almost like, you know, he can't quite figure out. And I think that we're going to see that ourselves and what it feels like to begin reopening and to begin being close with people again. Julia says, and we won't have the assurance from God that we can come out. We also won't have the command from God to come out. That it's so important, you know, in that midrash that speaks to Noah, that God has to tell Noah that it's safe to come out, that he should come out. Again, that sort of goes back to the stop and start nature of how are we going to know and what is it going to look like? Nancy says it might not be safe to mingle for a long time, not days, but months or even years. And so for me, then one of the questions is not only how do we rebuild out of loss, but how do we rebuild when we're still in that moment of loss? So we can't actually indefinitely stay in this period of, we have to start already doing the work of rebuilding, and yet we are still in the ark. And so that becomes a question for me. What are our ravens and doves for this time? Nathan, I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you mean by that. I have a beautiful midrash from Tamar Biala on the ravens and the doves. The ravens and doves as being the ones who first go out into the world, and there are different paths to resilience, but I'd love to hear what you mean by that.
Yes, as we know in the story, as he's waiting those 7 days, he sends the ravens, he sends the doves, and it's only when that dove does not return that he knows that it's safe to go out. Yeah. Not that he's still told by Hashem to go out. You're absolutely right. Yeah. But he is testing the waters, if you wish, and he's testing the air. He's testing the conditions. What do we do in the same way? And I don't mean contagion per se, but I mean this entire world of virus, unrest, brutality. How do we go back out into this world, and what do we use to test those waters?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nathan. I don't have the answer to that, but I'll just speak to this midrash for a moment that I referenced. This midrash from Tamar Biala, specifically on the doves. The focus of her midrash is what was the experience of the doves and ravens that were sent out to be sort of the first emissaries into the world to see for the first time what did the world look like. And they're very different responses. The raven and the dove's very different responses to being the first ones out into the world. But that's a great question, Nathan.
Yeah, I just don't want our school children to be the doves that go out into this world. And that's, unfortunately, some people think that is the correct step. Let the children go out. They're fine. They're a dove. They won't be damaged by the waters. And I think perhaps we are misguiding ourselves in different ways like that. But thank you for saying you don't have the answer. Makes you a real rabbi.
Okay, so with your permission, I appreciate so much you jumping in here. I want to go to Sarah's point that the flood was just one moment of destruction, but actually there are many moments of the world changing and being reshifting. So we're looking at a midrash from Bereishit Rabbah. So this is a collection of midrashim on the book of Genesis. And so it says, Amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon. So Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon says, Yehi Erev ein Kativ Kan, Ela Vayehi Erev. So in the Torah, it doesn't say, it was evening, Yehi Erev. Rather, it says, Vayehi Erev, and it was evening. That there's this added vav, there's this and, a conjunctive. Mikan Shehaya Seder Zmanim Koden Lechan. From here, we learn that there was actually an order of time that existed before that first, it was evening. The fact that it says, and it was evening, it implied that there was some time, that there was some sort of order of time that came before. So what does this mean? Amar Rabbi Abahu melamed chaya borei olamot umachrivan. Rabbi Abahu says, this teaches us that the Holy One would create worlds and would destroy them. Ad shebara et elu, until the Holy One created this world, these worlds. The Holy One would say, Mar den hanyali yaton lo hanyali. The Holy One would say, these do not please me, these please me, these do not please me. So the idea here is from the fact that it says Vayahi Erev and it was evening, a conjunctive, it implies that there was some sort of order of time that came before, that perhaps this was not the first time that God took to creating, and rather that before the creation of our world that we know it, God created and God destroyed multiple worlds. And when God would create these worlds, God would create the worlds and God would say, God would shake God's head and God would say, these don't please me. And then God would destroy them again. And then God would create more worlds and say, these still do not please me, until ultimately God created this world. And finally God said, these please me. And that's the, and it was good. It was tov. And then this world was allowed to sort of exist and to continue on, but it was only after so many other reiterations. Amar Rabbi Pinchas Tameh de Rabbi Abahu. So Rabbi Pinchas sort of followed the reasoning of Rabbi Abahu. Vayar Elohim et kol asher asad v'hine tov me'od, that God looked at all God did and it was tov me'od, it was very good. Again, following the logic of Dein hanyan li yaton lo hanyan li, this world pleases me, those other worlds did not please me. And so here we were getting this idea that actually our world was not the first world. It was not God's first stab at the drawing board, but actually our world is the result and only in the aftermath of God creating and destroying and creating and destroying many worlds. So this is obviously a midrash that is created by the rabbis. Doesn't this run contrary to the all-powerful God? What is the rabbi's agenda? Why do they create this midrash? What is gained by teaching this midrash, by imagining our world as only coming after the many attempts of creation and destruction? So what do we gain from this midrash? What does this add to our, what does it add to our understanding of the world? And also, what does it add to our understanding of God as creator? So how does this midrash impact how we understand the world? And how does it impact how we understand God? Okay, so Sarah says that this world is the world in which God chooses to stay. So Sarah, I'll add on to this, but you'll tell me if I'm understanding you correctly. There's a sense of, there's a sense in which it elevates our world, because it's to say, this was the, God tried multiple times, multiple reiterations, but this is the best iteration. And so there's a sense in it's sort of like, it's raising us up because finally God arrives at something good. Okay, great. So Nancy asks, how is this related to the Midrash about God taking Adam through Gan Eden and telling him that there would be no worlds created after this one, so be sure to take good care of it? That's an interesting connection there. Nancy, that you're making. The thing that's making me think of Nancy, though, is of course that God, on one hand, is saying there's going to be no other future attempts. There's going to be no future worlds. This is the world you have it, so you better take care of it. On the other hand, then you have God nearly destroying the world with the flood just chapters later. So that's sort of interesting to hold that balance there. Chana said they were establishing the yeshiva system in the wake of the temple's destruction. They needed to make this a godly mission to get the community to come along. Chana, I'd love to hear more about that. And Karen says, and that God could still decide we aren't worthy of staying. Ah, so Karen, you're adding in an element of fragility there. There's a sense in which at the moment God says this world pleases me, but at any moment, God could also decide this world too doesn't please me, and God could wipe out that world. So there's a sense on the one hand, we have what Sarah was saying of like, this is the best world, we made it. It elevates us and it elevates all of creation to say, this was it. This is what God wanted to stick with. And on the other hand, we are but like any other world, we could be destroyed too. And it gives a sense of fragility to our existence. Yeah, Bachi.
It's sort of more cynical, but I feel like there's kind of a picture of God here that's more like capricious. Like I almost imagine like a kid playing with blocks and like just like building a tower and then knocking it over and building another one and knocking it over. And it's a little, I guess continuing that idea of the fragility, things could change. But on the other hand, there's that idea that Chana started saying earlier, which is that there's always new creation. Like as much destruction as there is, there's always that next step of more creation. So I wonder if, depending on your mood, different aspects of it could strike you.
Right. Do you focus on the holiness and creation and the fact that there's always a next creation that we could be a part of, or do you focus on it feels like God, there's a God that's sort of just creating and destroying on the whim? There's an amazing book that I love called Mr. G, G for God, Mr. G by Alan Lightman, that imagines like sort of like a young God creating and destroying worlds. But I just think it's like a sort of totally different other genre of midrash on this. So something that I just want to highlight from this text. So I think it was Larry who was saying, doesn't this run contrary to the all-powerful God? Larry, in a sense, no. Because right at the end of the day, it's God who is creating and destroying. That's sort of like the essence of all powers, that I can create and destroy. But in a sense, absolutely yes. Because Larry, I think perhaps what your question there is, couldn't the all-powerful God just have created the world right the first time? Right, and God just create the first iteration and have that be the world? For me, I feel like there's maybe two lessons in it. One lesson there is that creation and innovation takes multiple reiterations, and it takes hard work, and that, if even God doesn't get it right the first time, that God comes back to the drawing board multiple times, so too for us, it might take us multiple reiterations, and that's okay, that's part of what creativity is creating and destroying, and seeing what comes out of that. And the second thing here is, I feel like for me, that very much sort of participating in an Amazon, I want it now sort of culture, sometimes the best things, the holiest projects, they take time. You have to sort of create and come back. It's not just like you do it and you create the world and that's it, but that there's a process of really being in relationship and engaging before the thing that you're working on can really come to fruition. And that we see that in God modeling that as a creator for us, is that this is what it means to be a creator. It means to come back to things multiple times. It means to destroy and to have to rebuild out of that destruction. Also, like Bachi, how painful it is as a kid to be building your tower and then to have your tower collapse and to be sobbing on the floor and to know, but you're just gonna have to build it again. Okay, so with your permission, let's go back into the text, and this will now be the foundation for this text that we're going to look at. The text that we're looking at comes from a 19th century rabbi, Rabbi Natan Zvi Finkel. This is from a collection of works called Or HaTzafun, The Hidden Light. And this is a chapter that's specifically called Chorban U'Binyan, from the destruction and rebuilding. So I'll read a fair amount of this in the original, because I want to get you to get to hear the language, but we'll move back and forth. So based on this midrash from Bereishit Rabbah that we just looked at, he says, "V'horei nimtza mikan she'olam lo nivra ela mitoch ha'chorban. And so from here, from this Midrash in Bereishit, we learn that the world was created only out of the Korban, only out of the devastation, the destruction of these previous worlds. Shemitoch shebara olam achar olam ve'amar aleihem, that in that, that God created world after world and said about them, yaton lo hanyan li ve'chrivotam, bara et olamo shemar lav dain hanyan li ve'kayamoto. And we learn that the world was only created out of destruction because God created world after world and said, these ones don't please me, and destroyed them, and then created this world and said about it, this world pleases me, and allowed it to sort of to establish, to stay, to exist. This line I love here. Uba'al korchinu, shegam bechorban ha'olamot yesh chokhma rabah. And we are forced to say, uba'al korchinu, we are forced to say almost against our will, that also in the destruction of the worlds, there is great wisdom. Because it is from this wisdom that the world, the sort of the everlasting world, sprouts and grows. Because the text says about this, that in wisdom, the world is established. And what is the wisdom? It is the wisdom of destruction. It is the wisdom that is found in these destructive acts, these multiple reiterations that are part of creation. And we find rather that this isn't chorban, it isn't actually destruction at all, rather this is the way of wisdom. That it's actually through the multiple different attempts of building the world and destroying the world that the foundation is established, and it's this foundation from which the world is able to be built. Sort of, he's going to make a leap here to a different idea that I also really love. So just to clarify this first idea, so he's saying, just expanding on Bereishit Rabba, the very fact that we see that the world is created only out of the Chorban, we are forced to say against the will that it must be in the Chorban, it must be in the destruction, there is great wisdom. And that actually it's not Chorban at all. It's not destruction at all. We see Chorban, we see destruction, and we think loss. But actually he's trying to get us to see a reframing and say, well, it must be that in their destruction, we're forced to say that there is wisdom. And this is just the pathway of wisdom, because it's through those multiple attempts that ultimately the basis of the world will be established. And from there, the world will be founded. Then he goes on to say, "V'hareza domeh." This is similar to the Hava Amina Umaskana Shabidivrei Torah. He says, and this idea of the sort of building out of destruction is similar to the language of Hava Amina and the conclusions that one finds in the words of Torah. What's Hava Amina? Hava Amina is the idea that you're learning Torah, you're learning Gemara, and the Hava Amina is what I would have initially thought. I initially would have said X. But then after only going back and forth, I realized that it must be Y. So your Hava Amina is your initial thought. I might have thought this was true. It's my initial world that I brought into creation. The Hava Amina, my first thought is that first world. I might have thought this first thing, this first world. But then after back and forth, I realized, oh, actually the Hava Amina is not true. And it's really this final conclusion. This is the thing that's true. He says this is similar to this process of Hava Amina and finding, coming to conclusions. Shegam the Hava Amina. Yesh hit amkut v'havana ve'ein lehu lemaskana elemetoch shakla v'tarya shebahava amina. He says, and also in the hava amina, also in your initial position of what I would have thought, there is great depth and wisdom, and you only come to the maskana, you're only able to come to that final conclusion because as a result of the back and forth, the shakla v'tarya, the back and forth that is contained in the hava amina. This is like sort of the image of the writer who writes page after page, crumples them up, throws it into the wastebasket. And there's a sense of seeing that build up pile of the crumpled wastebaskets. And he said, but actually those crumpled up papers, those are the Hava Amina, those are really important. And you only get to whatever that final published book is by the mound of crumpled up attempts in the wastebasket. And I think this is just a sort of a beautiful thought about the Hava Amina, about the creative process, is that you actually, those, even in your initial thoughts, even when they turn out to be wrong, even in your first steps that turn out to be missteps, they're in fact not missteps at all. They're steps along the way to understanding. I'm curious to hear how do you understand when he says, "Ba'al korchenu," we are forced to say that there is wisdom in destruction? And I wonder, does this feel true to you? How does this text resonate with you right now in this moment? Oh, good. So Michal says, I'm honored to have Michal in this class right now. Michal is also a colleague at Hadar, working on pedagogy of partnership, which is specifically working on bringing chavruta to school. So chavruta is the model of learning from each other. So Michal adds, this is in a sense how chavruta learning works, the exchange of ideas and learning together. So Michal, thank you for adding that this sort of back and forth, the Havamina Rai would have thought, and then clarifying that this is an essential part of, there's a sense of what are we doing in chavruta? We're sort of creating and destroying worlds, ultimately to come to the world that will be established. And Ron says this is very similar to the theories of evolution. Yeah. Rabbi Lepatin is troubled. So you said you wanted to be challenged. Tell me more about why you're troubled.
I mean, are we just a toy and our world and our loves and the people we love and people we care about and people are just God's like playing with, you know, God just playing with us and figuring things out? I don't want to be, I'm an object of a God's shock lavataria.
Yeah, so this I think goes back to what Bachi was suggesting of one image that this is presenting, sort of depending on your mood, is the sort of the cynicism of like, well, is God just like a kid playing with blocks and are we those blocks that are being destroyed at will? I very much hear that. I'm curious to see, we're going to move into a different section of the piece that's going to move us from being less the passive objects that God is playing with and more the our own agents in this. And so I'm curious to see if that's going to bring any sort of resolution or if that troubled sense will stand. But I think that that's a fair thing to be troubled by. So Nancy says, I was thinking of climate change too. I would have said that is a terrible and frightening thing to think, to see the catastrophic things that are happening all over the planet due to climate change and rising temperatures, unchecked human attacks on nature. Does this test suggest that in the end, all this will be seen as good and wise? Uh-huh. This can be a rationale for doing nothing while our world is destroyed. So Nancy, I think that that's a really interesting point. So Nancy is saying, there's a sense in which like, if it's all good, all of our messing around and fumbling around and not know what we're doing, if ultimately it's all good, does that in a sense give us permission to not really take responsibility for our actions? I think that that's a really good question. I guess the thing that I would say is, less like, oh yeah, the world is destroyed and then there's a world that stands and that's the good world, and more that we have to take really active agency in the destruction, looking for what is the wisdom that the wisdom doesn't come out on its own, that we have to be the seekers of that wisdom to figure out, we have an obligation to figure out how do we make the next world, not just the next iteration, but the best world that we actually learn something from the world we're in. And so even in this moment, I'm thinking, to the extent that we're seeing our society sort of crumble around us and realizing that like social systems are not in place that needed to be placed, and there are people who are vulnerable, who are much more vulnerable than other people, how do we not just create the next reiteration of the world, but actually what is the wisdom to be learned in this moment that's going to make sure that the next world we make is a better world? And Nancy, I totally hear you how one could take that text as a sort of like stepping back and not having agency. And if anything, I want to read more into like, what does it look like to actively shift through the rubble of our failure right now to make the better world? Okay, Bachi, yeah, please.
And I actually think that that is partially like a potential answer to Rabbi Lopatin's discomfort, like, you know, reflecting our human understanding of this with like our understanding of how this works for God. Like that's kind of the difference between the capricious, like childish God of just like putting blocks together, pushing them over, putting them on, is there's no learning. There's no like actually building from one iteration to the next intent and kind of creative energy on God's part, the same way that we kind of aspire to for ourselves. Like that it's not just, you know, isn't like the classic thing that it's insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, thinking it'll be different one of the times, but like that's not what we're trying to do. That shouldn't be what we're trying to do. And so too, like with the world creating stories, that wouldn't really be creation. I think that would be destruction. And creation, I feel like the point that Rabbi Natan Zvi Finkel is making is that the destruction has to be in the name of something, right? And that's actually, sorry to go on a little tangent, like even in Melacha, like for Shabbat, which is also like about creative acts, like if you're just destroying something to destroy it, I don't think that's a Melacha. But if you're destroying something in order to make it useful in a new way, that's what we consider like a creative act that you're not allowed to do on Shabbat.
That's an amazing connection to make, Bachi, that destruction for the sake of destruction is not creation, but it actually has to be destruction with the intent to create something. And how might those, like, are we in a moment of, is what's happening with climate change, is that destruction for the sake of destruction, but not destruction with the intent to create something? And is that how it's, it feels different? But I just saw what Deborah wrote. Authors, writers call it killing your darlings, getting rid of a formerly wonderful phrase, sentence, paragraph, chapter for something stronger that betters the eventual whole work. And there's something so powerful about that, Deborah, that phrase, killing your darlings. I think, again, this goes back to perhaps a little bit speaking to what Rabbi Lipat and his discomfort and what Bachi is saying, is, again, not just an image of some capricious kid building, destroying, building, destroying, but actually a being that is, it's not just like, these don't please me, this pleases me, I'm moving on, but that there's such a love and intensity, and yet for the sake of the work, the ultimate work, that it's out of that love that you have to destroy to keep, to create whatever the next thing is. So I love that, Deborah, that's very powerful, killing your darlings. Yeah, Nathan.
Thank you. Going back to what Bachi said, which was brilliant, capriciousness is not what's here. It's wisdom equaling free will, in a sense. And if wisdom and free will do equal each other in the most omnipotent being and infinite wisdom that God has, if we are supposed to act like God, as we are commanded to, God's teaching us, in your free will, use wisdom, not capriciousness. And so this destructions of many worlds in the Midrash is not a capricious act. It's not random. It's with wisdom that God is trying to create a world to put the Torah within. And it takes God some time to do that. If you want to take this a little further, it takes God some time to find the right family and people to give the Torah to. It parallels the whole story. Adam is not right. Noah is not right. I'm going to start with this guy named Avram and see if that works. Many worlds, many people. I don't think God's randomness. Einstein.
Yeah. Thank you, Nathan. Hannah, I want to come to you in a second. I just also want to read out Robert's very important chat. After the Shoah, many people remarried and had new families on the ruins of the old, but there was no wisdom in the destruction of the old. So Robert, if you want to speak to this, I'd love to have you speak to it. But what I'm taking from your comment, which I think could be something very dangerous about this teaching, so I appreciate that. What I think that you're raising it is that there could be a sense of, even Nancy was saying this too, with the climate change of like, well, everything works out in the end. It doesn't matter. In all, there's a sense of minimizing the loss and destruction and sort of making a claim that all loss and destruction is for the sake of wisdom, or there is wisdom to be gained from all loss or destruction, sort of a washing of that experience, because it's for the sake of the better world. This a little bit, I feel like, actually reminds me, takes me back to my caution with the Rabbi Nachman text last week and the resilience of a sense of taking someone else's experience of loss and destruction and saying, oh, don't worry, there's wisdom in it. You'll come out, it's all for the sake of good. You're going to come out on the other end. That's sort of the danger in that. So Robert, I appreciate you flagging that and saying that there was no wisdom in the destruction of all of the lives that were lost in the Holocaust. There's not a wisdom in that. I think, Robert, what I would say, that in this destruction, sometimes there is wisdom. Some types of destruction and some types of losses, there is wisdom to be gained. And sometimes it's not about, for me, is there wisdom? But do you have the ability to rebuild? That sometimes we're focusing on the wisdom and sometimes we're focused on the ability to rebuild. And so I want to hear Hannah's comment, and then I want to read the next part of the text, and I'll tie back to your comment, Robert, but I just really appreciate that. Hannah.
The wisdom isn't necessarily finding that this is good. Only we're in the image of God, but only God finds that good. And that's also what Rabbi Lipat was saying. It's just like, we as individual egos have a lot of trouble with the idea that we're part of this phenomenon of that the world is built on destruction, and that And even, and I love the idea of the killing your darlings thing, but as an artist, I see it more as the actual material of the world. The actual physical material of the world is annealed out of old stuff. Yeah. You know, when you build glass, it's made out of broken glass. And then, and that strengthens the glass. So it's like, it's more fundamental than that was our first draft. And now this is our new draft. This is more that the world would not exist. It's kind of like, do you know that poem by Naomi Shihab Nye about kindness? We know kindness because we've suffered or we've had these, we've been broken so we can be, you know, and so that the world is fundamentally broken, and that's the sadness of it. And that it, we're not saying that, you know, Rabbi Nachman might not even have been saying that, don't be sad, be happy. He was saying the world is sad, but it's something life-affirming about that too, because that's the tragedy of it, is that we're built on brokenness. That's fundamentally what it is. So anyway, so that's...
I appreciate that, Hannah, that reframing of actually there's a sense in which the image of the crumbled up papers going in the wastebasket is actually entirely wrong, because really, really, because that's like, you take the materials and then it goes somewhere else and then you start again. But actually what it is it's the same materials keep being sort of broken and reshaped and broken, reshaped, and that it's all contained within it there. It sort of reminds me that there's like a Jewish legal question of if you take a vessel and break it and re-glue it back together, is it the same vessel or does it become a new vessel that feels like it's contained? Somehow it has all the same pieces, but is it transformed entirely into something else? So Robert was just noting that comment about the Shoah came from his wife, Amy. So Amy, I really appreciate your comment and you making it, and I want to come back to that. So thank you. Ulam k'shebara ha-kadosh baruch hu et ha-adam yatsar oto b'tzalmo b'tzalem Elokim. But when the Holy One created human beings in God's image, the Holy One created them in the image of God, b'tzalem Elokim. Shelo yeh muchrach l'kayam tzav Hashem kedugmat bru'im acherim, that they wouldn't be, I think Nathan, you might have been specifically speaking to this, that they wouldn't be forced to uphold the commandment of God as with other creatures, that other creatures have to do whatever God says, but that human beings were given free will, that they could or they could not. Ela sheyet tavua bo koach ha-bechira v'yuchal lif'ol kekol ha'ole b'yertono. Rather, implanted in them would be koach ha-bechira, it would be free will, and they could act according to whatever came up in their desire. V'domela kadosh baruch hu, as is the like with the Holy One, that just as the Holy One has free will, part of what it means, one answer to what does it mean to be created b'tzelem Elokim in the image of God, is just like God has free will, koach ha-bechira, so too we have koach ha-bechira, we have free will, and we could either follow God's commandment or we cannot follow God's commandment. Second thing, ubiyado le'achriv v'gam livnot, and also in our hands as humans is the ability to destroy and also to create. So this is Rabbi Lepat, and this is where this piece is where I see is going to go into less seeing us as the passive objects that God is playing with, but actually we are also the agents of creation and destruction. V'nimtza eifo shekshem sha'kadosh baruch hu ba'al chokhmat yisod ha'aretz kivichol, in the midst of, so in the same way that God, the Holy One, comes to wisdom through the foundation, through the establishment of the earth, as it seems in the creation of there's a midrash that says that God created 974 worlds God created and destroyed before our world. So it's not just that Bereishis Rabbah would have us think there were some worlds created, but actually they sort of nail it down based on a midrashic reading that there's 974 worlds that God created and destroyed. Ken baha adam el chokhmat yetzira ubinyan holam mitoch hakorban shehu. So too, I'm going to just pause there. So too, a person comes to the wisdom of creation and the creating of the world through destruction. In what way does a person parallel that process? Ka'amor bepechinat hava amina umaskana. In the same way that a person is like God, because a person has this back and forth of I would have thought and coming to conclusions, and this is much like God's own creative process. And all of this is nothing other than development and the deepening of wisdom. And this is the essence of what it means. Oh, Hannah, thanks for sharing that poem. And this is the essence of what it means for a person to be created in the image of God. And in this way, a person rises above the level of angels because they weren't created in God's image in this way. So the key here is what he's saying is, he's saying two things. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? One is that just like God has koach ha-bechira, has free will and can do what God wants, so too a person is not actually bound to keep God's commandments, but can choose to do whatever they want. The second part is what I really want to focus on here. And in the same way that God has the ability to create and to destroy, and specifically to then create out of destruction, to create out of the ruins, so too a person, it's in a person's ability, in their hands, to create and destroy. And so he's saying fundamentally, what does it mean to be created in the image of God? It means that we, like God, have the ability to create and destroy. And we, like God, have the ability to create out of the ruins, to create out of destruction. Rather, this is, as we said, this is just the way of the world, that the Holy One creates worlds and destroys them. And that it is through the destruction that a world that is even better, that is even higher and more exalted, is created. And this is the greatness of a human being that is created in God's image. That is also in the, what is the greatness of a person? That they have in their power to come from the bad to the good, from destruction to the establishment, to the correcting of the world. And it is actually through all of these great fallings, the downfalls, this goes back to me, what you were saying at the beginning, that there's not just the destruction of the flood, but there's a sense in which our world is always shifting. It's always becoming unrecognizable. And then we're having to power through it, that there's actually not one yerida. There's not one downfall we experience, but there are a succession of yeridot in our lives, of downfalls that we experience. But with each one of them, it's in the person's ability to become even higher and to lift themselves up, and not only to meet ale, to lift themselves up, ma'ale, to also lift others up with them. So for me, I feel like this is just a profoundly, possibly empowering in text on what it means to be human, what it means to be created, but selam elokim, to be created in God's image, is that we, like God, have the power to create out of destruction, and that we have the power to go from bad to good, to go from destruction to establishing a world. And not only when we do that, do we have the power to lift ourselves up, but that also we can raise other people up with us. So Amy, this is just to go back to your comment. Again, I really appreciate sort of the danger of a text like this and sort of redeeming all loss and destruction and saying there's wisdom in all of it. I wouldn't want to suggest that. What feels hopeful is to say, sort of the fact of what it means to be created in God's image, is that we have the ability to go from the destruction to the establishing of the world, that somewhere within us, again, this sort of goes back to the Rebbe Nachman, sometimes we feel like we don't have it. Sometimes all we can do is open our eyes in the morning. That's all we really have the power to do. We don't actually have the power to redeem the world. We just have the power to get up or to open our eyes. But that somewhere in us, in what it means to be created in God's image, is we have the power to keep going and to rebuild and to eventually lift ourselves up and to hopefully, God willing, lift others up with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how this is resonating with you. So Rebecca says, even though God isn't going to destroy the world again, per the Rainbow Covenant, we humans still have the power to destroy it. Yeah, so Rebecca, that is in the text. I want to focus on the part of the text, and it's important that you're raising it. I want to focus on the part of the text that's about creating. And creating out of destroying, but you're right, Rebecca, that part of what's in there, and this maybe goes back to Nancy's comment, is that we are also given the power to destroy. So there's sort of a dual responsibility there. On the one hand, there's the opportunity that we can create out of destruction, but also sort of the terrifying power that we can also be the destroyers there. Paul, yeah.
Is it really creating something new, or is it just redirecting the energy that's already been created. Because like the first law of thermodynamics, for example, right? You can't create anything or destroy anything. So it's like creation's finished, but we have the ability to change the energy that's already been created to either do good or bad or make something new out of it. Well, you know, you understand what I'm saying? That part doesn't resonate with me.
That it's creating something totally new.
Right. Like yeah. Creation is finished. Like we have creation, you know, revelation and redemption. Creation's done, you know, but it's taking the energy that's already been created.
Yeah.
And then redirecting it.
Yeah, I appreciate the reframing. I think that also goes to the sort of Hannah's reframing of it's not about like the all the discarded things and creating something new, but actually there's a sense in which it's just reshaping the materials that you already have. So Rabbi LePatin says, I love the idea of rebuilding. Perhaps we have no right to destroy, but we can know that we can rebuild, right? So we have to, like, as humans, know that we have the power to do both and try to lean into the power to rebuild and lean away from the power to destroy. Nancy says, there are different categories of destruction. What the Midrash describes as God's repeated destructions of the world that did not please God is very different from human beings decided to engage in wanton destruction, which often destroys the good in our world. So good, Nancy. I feel like that's, again, going along with Rabbi LePatin's comment of acknowledging that we are given the ability to destroy. And also, you know, Bachi's comment of thinking about the different types of destruction, of understanding what's going on with climate change is sort of a category of wanton destruction, destruction without the intent to create, and recognizing the different types of destruction that exist in the world. So Bachi's saying, I think Larry and Ariana's framing of creation might help, Paul. Creation might be an ongoing thing, not a singular event. Thus, we can have a role, if not as initiators of a creation, then as perpetuators of it, maintainers of it. I think that is powerful to think of creation here as being something that's ongoing. And in the same way, going back to Sarah's comment, in the same way that the Yeridot, the downfalls are ongoing, that our world is, it's the end of the world as we know it, and then the world is remade, and it's the end of the world as we know it, and the end of the world is remade. So in the same way that these Yeridot, these downfalls are going to keep coming, so too there are there opportunities to keep remaking things anew, to creating anew, as Ariana's pointing out, that God creates the world anew each day. We're not going to see this text inside, but if you want to just look on the next, when you take home your source sheet, the last paragraph, Rabbi Finkel just actually sort of names, gives examples of the various Yeridot, the various downfalls and the way we come out of it, that we go from, you know, the destruction of the Garden of Eden into Noah, and we go from Noah into the flood, and from the flood, from sort of the tumah, the impurity of being Egypt, we come into relationship with God, that there are actually just all these different moments of going down and coming out, going down and coming out. And we can see the same process in our own lives of places in which we've gone down and places in which we've come out of it. That there's a sort of continuous effort to be made anew. Okay, so this poem comes from the Jewish poet Adrian Rich, All I Cannot Save.
My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world.
My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who, age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world.
Thank you to both of you for reading that. So I'll just say one quick final thought. There's a couple of things that I just love about this poem. I mean, the first thing I love is my heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I think this goes back to Amy's comment on not redeeming everything that's been destroyed. That there is just the fact of destruction, that sometimes things are destroyed, lives are lost. And that's a fact. We can't come back from it. We don't find wisdom in that. That there, again, this is going to the Rabbi Nachman of, I look around and the world is in despair, that sometimes suffering is a fact. And I think the poet here is acknowledging that, that sometimes there are things that cannot be saved, that are just destroyed and they're just lost. And at the same time, that the poet is saying, I cast my lot with those who, I love this line, perversely, with no extraordinary power. On the one hand, this text is saying we have the power, that we are made in the image of God, that we, like God, have this power. And sometimes we feel like we don't have the extraordinary power. Sometimes we feel like we can't even go on. Sometimes we feel like we have no hope. And yet somehow, with no extraordinary power, sort of against the odds, against all sort of thinking that we might do it, perversely somehow, we are able to reconstitute the world. And again, we see here in the echo of what Larry and what Hannah was saying, that it's not sort of create a new world out of nothing, but the sort of sense of reconstituting the world is to pick back the pieces up, rebuild it together, remold it, create it in something new to take what is there and to bring it back together. And so my hope and my blessing for all of us is that we can find the strength in ourselves to hold the loss, to hold the suffering as Rabbi Nachman is asking us to hold it, to even chase after it, to go after it. And at the same time, to see ourselves as creating B'tzelo Elokim, and what it means to be created in the image of God is even when we don't feel like we have the power, even when we feel like we are lacking the hope, to know that what it means to be created in the image of God is that we too can rebuild out of the destruction, and we too can go forward. And the blessing is that we not only can lift ourselves up in the next reiteration, but that we actually have the ability to lift up other people there.